So what I want to do today is I want to finish using a spin to look at local fields. And then tomorrow, what we'll do is we'll go to a microscopic system. So one of the things we'd like in a quantum processor is to have a quantum processor which is the size of an atom so that we can bring it to within an atomic distance to study materials and other things. And of course, there's also this picture that you see described often, which is a little bit iffy, of you're going to make your processor by placing atoms one at a time right where you want them. Chemistry usually has something to say about that, but it's a nice concept to the extent that you can do it. But let's finish. So we're measuring local fields. And the standard approach is again to look at Ramsey fringes. And then to say that the magnetization that we would see at that moment is equal to integral over the distribution of local fields course, it's limited by the T2, and we're going to integrate over that distribution. And of course, this pulse here, we're detecting along Z here. And that pulse is just to transform the XY magnetization, so it has a component along Z. And you know, it's just as nice to say, oh, let's just take this whole thing as the detection so that I can put this pi over 2 pulse in my detection operator and then say, well, I'm effectively detecting X and Y. And so we have this. Now, of course, what we saw in looking at a single spin one-half particle is that we could measure the Zeeman frequency, we can measure T1, we can measure T2, we can measure the Rabi frequency, and then we are left with this distribution. And we'd like to learn something about that. And of course, if we simply measured this signal and took a Fourier transform, then the signal that we would have would be this distribution convolved with the Lorentzian line shape. Okay, and so then we would get a piece of the distribution. We would say, oh, I know what the static distribution is. And we looked at how to map out the change of that distribution over a time. If I just gave myself a finite window, I said, okay, I'm going to evolve for some time, wait for some time with the spins along Z, and then evolve again. But now what I want to do is to give some more physics into be local. And the first thing we did was to say we add a magnetic field gradient. I add a field gradient that I impose. So this is outside of the system. And then, of course, the field as a function of Z is equal to whatever the field was before plus the spatially varying piece. And just to say it, it is easy enough to create such a field just by so-called Maxwell pair, which is similar to a Helmholtz coil, but the current flows in the opposite direction in one half of it. Now, of course, you can't generate a gradient in just one direction in a field, and so there'll be gradients of dvx dx and dvy dy, but those pieces will not couple into the spin system. It's another example of the rotating wave approximation, that if I have a strong field along z, adding a weak field along x, the motion of the spins around z effectively suppress any evolution from the field along x. Okay, so now then we have this, and we say, well, this magnetic field gradient introduces a correlation between the spins phase and its location. And we saw that in terms of this wave number. So now we take exactly our same answer with exactly the same experiment. But now then we get the term that replaces the local field term. With this piece. So now that is showing up for the local field. And of course, if I looked at this, gamma is 2 pi hertz per Gauss. The gradient is Gauss per centimeter. Z is centimeter. And of course, t is time. Time is in seconds. And so I can define a wave number in terms of the gradient strength and the time the system has evolved for. And therefore, our exponential takes on the beautifully simple form, k is a function of time, time z. Okay. And we started to look at that. We applied an experiment due to Erwin Hahn. Where Erwin applied a pi pulse. Now, you know, he didn't have this picture of what was going on, so we'll show you his picture in a second. But if I look at this system, then right after this x pulse, I'll put it along y, this y pulse, 90 degree pulse, all the spins are lined up along the x-axis, and of course, we're looking at what happens over some sample in z. So now what we're imagining is we have some large spread out sample. It's spread out along the z-axis, and as we wait for some time, this will get wrapped up into a helix. And the pitch of the helix defines the wave number. And so here, clearly, we could observe spatial information. And of course, if we were doing MRI, then we've done the whole experiment right there, right? Because I could change the pitch of the helix, and I could measure the density of spins corresponding to that spatial frequency over a sample. And since by weighting, I could change the helix to anything I wanted to, then I could measure a complete, in this case, one-dimensional image of a sample. And that's, of course, how we do MRI. Now, the pi pulse, and let's put it along x for our convenience. So it'll take sigma x to sigma x. It'll take sigma y to minus sigma y. And we don't care about the sigma z, but it'll invert that as well. And so what will happen is we'll invert this, and I won't be able to draw it correctly. Not sure why I even try. The y-axis is inverted. It goes, must be some nice way of drawing this. Well, let me draw it like that, but it's not true, because there I've shown the x-axis. But it changes. And of course, what we have said, pi over 2 pi, is that we could draw the k vector, and it would increase. And at this pi pulse, because we're swapping y for minus z, then we change the helicity of this. But then the gradient is still in the same direction, so the change in wave number with time is in the same direction. And at this moment, all the spins come back to being in phase. And we would see an echo. So if I was integrating across the sample, then of course, when I integrated over the helix, if the spins were uniformly spread over that helix, then I would see zero signal. If they weren't uniformly spread, then I would see whatever that Fourier component is. Here, since everything comes back in phase, regardless of the location, then I would see a signal here that is almost the same magnitude as the original signal, except it decays as the T2 of the sample, right? But otherwise, it would have no measure of the local fields at that point. Okay? And then, given here that we have a helix, then it's useful to take that and to look a little bit deeper at what happens. And the first piece, so we talked, and I left you with a problem about a uniform velocity and a plug flow. But I'm going to come back to that in just a second. And let's ask a simpler question first. Maybe it's actually a harder question, but it'll have a nice analysis. What happens if there's molecular diffusion? So you know that molecular diffusion is just a random walk of molecules, and that what it tells us is that we have a distribution for the change in location of the spin. That is given by a Gaussian, where sigma is the square root of 2dt. Okay. And of course, the way you want to think about diffusion is that every spin is going to diffuse according to that model. So if I looked at any slice here, then the magnetization in that slice is going to get spread out because of molecular diffusion. And so then this problem, which was first looked at by Torrey, has an easy solution that says, if I have spins along x, and I apply a magnetic field gradient, for some time, I'm going to wrap them up into some helix. I'm going to use k0 because that's a particular value of the helix. I've wrapped them up to some helix. And then if I allow molecular diffusion, then I should convolve that with this probability distribution of how the spins move. And then I want to know what that is. And it's easiest, from my point of view, to go into reciprocal space. So if I just take a Fourier transform and go from real space to reciprocal space, then of course a helix is given, has only one wave number, so we get a delta function at that wave number. You'll remember that if we're convolving, we should be multiplying, and that the Fourier transform of a Gaussian is a Gaussian. I've normalized this Gaussian, and so the correct Gaussian here is e to the minus k squared sigma squared over 2. There's no prefactor because, of course, the amplitude of this at k equals 0 has to be 1 because that's the area under this distribution. And so now we have a nice result that says, hey, I get this wave number, but the wave number is only going to sample at k equals 0. So I get an attenuation, e to the minus k naught squared sigma squared over 2 is the attenuation of the grating. Of course, a random motion isn't going to change the helicity of the gradient, right? The random motion is going to leave the helicity alone because this is symmetric. So it's as likely to go up as it is down. But of course, as I move spins from here that way or that way, then I'm going to reduce the size of the gradient. And so we take the inverse Fourier transform, and we get the term that is e to the minus k naught squared sigma squared over 2 e to the I k naught z. And I told you that sigma is square root of 2 dt. And so this piece, the attenuation, is equal to e to the minus k naught squared dt. And so here, where we have a random motion, we get back an exponential decay as we wanted to get back. And of course, what we see is that the faster the diffusion, or the finer the helicity, the finer the pitch, the faster the attenuation is. Yeah? Now you'll find lots of discussions around this as, oh, this is really T cubed. Because of course, in this particular experiment, K depends linearly on T. Right? K is increasing linearly with T. But they're just looking at the wrong physics. The physics is we have an attenuation because we have a sensitivity to location given by the grating. And of course, some scrambling of that information given by molecular diffusion, and that scrambling is, we cannot reverse it, right? So we lose information. Good. Now, let's compare two cases. So I'm going to put this set of pi pulses, and we'll put the K vector here. And of course, it's going to increase. At this point, it's going to change sign. Then it's going to increase at exactly the same rate. So I should try to do that so it's parallel, something like that. And then it's going to change sign, etc. And so by giving a series of pi pulses, then we get the series of echoes. All right. Now, let me do a different experiment. I'm going to keep the same pi over 2 pulse. But now let me apply a pi pulse more often. Good. So now here we go up the same path, right? Same gradient. And we get inverted. We go up. It gets inverted. We go up. Inverted. We go up. Inverted, etc. Okay. A little bit messy. And this one is drawn incorrectly. Let's look at this early piece where I drew things more correctly. Which of these two, if I take one place, it doesn't matter where, and say, ah, what's the attenuation over this sequence? Which of those sequences will have a faster attenuation and why? And why?
Because your first sequence gets larger values of k.
Absolutely. So by having more and more of these refocusing pulses, we have a shorter excursion. We're not as sensitive to diffusion. And so even though we're looking at them over the same period of time, the effect of this truly random molecular diffusion process is less, where we're refocusing more often. We just don't give ourselves the chance to be as sensitive to it. Okay? And of course, we can use that as one of our diagnostics of, are we truly looking at diffusion? Now, let's go back to the story that we had of asking what happens if the spins move more interestingly. So, since we're looking at correlating the location, then let me simply write down a power series for the location of the spin over time. And we're applying a molecular field gradient, which I told you was just a current in a set of wires. And so I can make that current time dependent. At the end of the day, I'm going to connect it back to the pi pulse. But let's just think about this current for a second. So let's make the strength of the magnetic field time dependent. And to give us a nicer equation, let's just call the strength of the magnetic field as a function of time, G. So then we can again follow our spin physics. And so if we're looking at the phase, all we need to do is integrate the motion over the magnetic field gradient. And so this is the only piece I care about. And so I'll rewrite that. But I'm going to pull apart the power series in Z. And so that this term becomes the integral of gamma And so now you see that we've written this in terms of the moments of G. And you're used to this. So if I had a magnetic field that was on continuously, so I'm plotting G of T, then of course, all of these integrals would be non-zero, and we would be sensitive to all of the moments of Z. But if I arranged that the first moment of G was equal to zero, that I'm only sensitive to the velocity, the acceleration, the jerk. I'm no longer sensitive to the location of the spins, which is the case of what we just saw there. And of course, if I took the second moment, then we would be sensitive to Z2, Z3, et cetera. Be sensitive strictly to the acceleration. We wouldn't be sensitive to the velocity or to the location of the system. And so we can run through a series of these. Now, it's useful to plot out the k-vectors. So the k-vector, of course, for this looks like that. The k-vector for this looks like that, right? That the k-vector increases, but then since we change the sign of the magnetic field gradient, then the evolution under that inverted magnetic field gradient tends to unwind the helix that we wound up. And here, hey. Here it looks like that. And of course, for all of the moments, anything that's going to be insensitive to Z0, when we're measuring, the wave number must go back to zero. In order for there to be a velocity, we need to have a picture like this. And in fact, it wouldn't matter if we had that picture. It would show up in exactly the same way. And I won't write down the math, but it's easy for you to write down the math and see that if you had a pi pulse and you didn't change the sign of the gradient, that you would end up with two negative signs to add. And so you get exactly the same result at the end. Okay, so here we say position. We're going to be sensitive to position, velocity, acceleration, etc. Good. Now when I look at this one again and re-ask my question. So now we have a pi over 2 pulse, and the question was with a pi pulse, so that the k vector is going up, down, and then back to here. And if I draw the spins, if there's a uniform velocity, so first I want some insight and then we'll get the answer. If there's a uniform velocity, what does it do to the grating? What does it do to this helix if I have a uniform velocity along Z? What I wanted you to say is that if we wind up a helix and there's a uniform velocity, then it's as though we translated the helix. And so we would have our helix with no velocity and with velocity, and it would be separated. And of course, you could come right here and look at the same thing. If I was going to replace the distribution that describes molecular diffusion with the distribution that describes velocity, then that distribution that describes velocity would be a delta function shifted away from zero, right? Everything had moved over by some amount. And then, of course, once I convolve with that delta function, then I would just shift the whole helix over. So maybe in your tutorial today, you'll show me that at the end of this experiment, the spins will have picked up a phase, but they'll all come back if it's uniform velocity under this experiment. They'll all come back in phase, just not along the original axis. And this phase is going to be k naught times the displacement in z divided by 3. So that, of course, is just the velocity times time. And this factor of 3 comes in because here I describe the attenuation for an instant in time. If I want to describe the attenuation over the whole path, then I need to integrate it. So for the attenuation over the path, then I get an integral that is k as a function of time, but let's just call that dk dt squared times squared dt times d, right? Where I'm just integrating over the exponent in the attenuation. And so we get the term that is dt cubed, but I'm going to put t squared back into here. So let me write it out. I get a term that's then we get the factor of 3. And of course, that's what you expect, right? That when you're winding up your helix, there's no attenuation here. And the attenuation becomes quadratically more important as you get closer to the maximum. It's most important at the maximum. Yeah? Okay. Although we have too much to talk about, we're still going to end on time. Meaning that next class we're going to start talking about diamond NVs. When Hahn described the echo, he didn't actually describe this experiment because at that moment he couldn't do that experiment. The experiment he described was this one, because he could give two of the exact same pulses. He couldn't give two pulses that were different. Which sounds trivial today, but 60 years ago it was hard. And it's a nice exercise to show that any two pulses return an echo. But let's look at this one. If I wind up my helix and I give a pi over 2 pulse about x, then of course the pi over 2 pulse is going to take sigma x to sigma x. It'll take sigma y to sigma z. And it'll take sigma z to minus sigma y. And so if here I have a helix, after this pulse, then along the x-axis, in the xy plane, I have just an amplitude modulation, right? So that just the x component is modulated along z. And the y component is always zero, because the y component came from z and there was nothing along z to begin with. And of course, the z component has this modulation as well. But the z component of the spin isn't going to change with the magnetic field gradient, right? The z component of the spin has this helicity, but it's going to stay there. It has this oscillation. And anytime we see this amplitude modulation, we've already seen that once in a class, we can decompose that into a right and left-handed helix. So if I take a right-handed helix and add it to a left-handed helix, then I would get a modulation that's only along one axis. Yeah? And so this piece is equivalent to having a signal at k naught and the signal in the helix at minus k naught, but they're each half as intense as they would have been otherwise. And so I get a piece here, I get the piece here, the system continues to evolve, and at the time t later after the second pulse, we again get an echo. We get an echo of half the spin, not of all the intensity. Now Hahn, during all this time, Hahn was a postdoc at the University of Illinois. From this nice work, he then got the faculty position at Berkeley. But he described this experiment, that you have the spin come up, the same experiment I have there. At this moment, we split, but they're each half of an intensity. I won't care so much about that. And then these continue, and at this moment, which is poorly drawn, we get an echo for half the spins. And then he gives another pi over 2 pulse, but fortunately, quantum mechanics is linear. So we know that we can just look at every component we like. And so this piece gets split into two. And this piece gets split into two. And so we get an echo here. And an echo here. And there's one more echo that's important. There's actually two more echoes, but one more that's important. Remember that we said that there was this z piece sitting there. And of course, the gradient is along z. So the gradient is not going to change that. But this pi over 2 pulse is going to take that z piece and put it back in the xy plane. And when it does, it's going to again create signals. So we have the z piece. It's going to again create signals that are at plus k and minus k. And the minus k piece is going to come and give us an echo right here. And this echo is the time tau after the second pulse. This one continues on too, but it never gives us an echo. And this echo is called the stimulated echo. And is famous because during the time between the second and third pi over two pulse, the information is stored along Z. So IBM, for instance, took out the patent on this to call that a bit. And so at one point, when they were looking at making computers, they were looking for better memory. At that point, you were using core memory. And they thought, having a magnetic domain based upon nuclear magnetism would be a good way of having core memory because the lifetime is very long. And so they could store information in little pieces of gypsum and keep it around by doing exactly this experiment and changing the phase of that pulse to go from 0 to 1. And the key is that during this time, since the magnetization is stored along Z, it decays by T1. Whereas for all of these other echoes, they're always decaying by T2. And T2 is much shorter than T1. Okay? Now, we're out of time. I want to show you one more thing. Das liked this experiment. Many people publish things following up and saying, well, how many echoes do you have if you have 4 pulses? Or how many echoes do you have if you have 9 pulses? And they're mostly wrong. A class I was teaching published the right answer about a decade ago. But Das, who's a famous guy, you might know the Das Institute in India, published a result called the virtual echo. And if you add a 4th pulse here, you get the virtual echo here. That is a time tau removed from that pulse. I wanted you to tell me a few things that are obviously wrong. What's that? It violates causality, which seems like a problem. It wasn't for him, but it would seem like a problem for me. And he had some really complicated analysis. He could eventually go through and find it. The next thing that was wrong for me was that he publishes this in a really obscure journal. And if you're going to violate causality, you should publish it in a really important journal, right? The last thing is that he has the data to show it works, which one can cringe at in this day and time. No virtual echoes. So what we're going to do is tomorrow, we're going to go and we're going to take and move to the atomic scale. And so that we can say, I have one spin. And can I use that one spin to say something, hopefully more quantum mechanically than what we've been saying, about its interactions with other spins, and then build up a quantum computer. Now, here, where we've been measuring these local fields, of course, there's lots of reasons for measuring local fields. MRI is one reason. All of these moments here leads to good diagnostic measures. So if you have fat buildup in your arteries, then it changes the statistics of what the flow profile looks like. And so we can use NMR to see if your flow looks different than smooth velocity that's pulsed. In fact, you can use it to tease out that there's a turbulent nature in the flow. And so we can tell that something's not as it should be. And of course, we can do that non-invasively. We can also use such methods to find underground streams. They're used for mapping the Earth's magnetic field, which is used for navigation to find both the orientation and the strength of the local Earth's magnetic field. Okay, there was another one I wanted to say, but I forget it. But the two most common use, oh, we use it for oil exploration. We use it for finding water in tundra. So if you have tundra, then you get pools of water underneath it. We also use it for characterizing ice. If we go to Antarctica, then the Antarctic ice shelf has many, many different types of ice, which are mixtures of ice and water. And they tell you about how the ice was formed, what the weather conditions were then. But it also tells you about what's going to happen in the future. And so you can take your NMR system and go out and drill a hole in the ice and measure it there, or you can be nice and warm and let your colleagues go out there and take an ice core and freeze it and bring it back to you. But the main use is for cheese. That if you have cheese, you're processing cheese, you want to have just exactly the right amount of rot going through your cheese. And so what you don't want is you don't want channels of water going through your cheese, because then it's not going to have a long shelf life. What you want is that the water flow through cheese is a complicated structure that has no large paths and no preferred direction. And by just measuring the diffusion response, you can see that that's the case. You can see how diffusive or how transportive do these channels look. The other thing you can do, so almost every sample of cheese has been in an NMR. And now if you have chocolate, you want sort of the opposite. So chocolate, you want it to melt only at a nice certain temperature, and you want it to melt uniformly. And for that to happen, you need the fat droplets in chocolate to be of exactly the right size. And they should only be droplets. They should never be connected to each other, right? You don't want your leave your chocolate in the sun and it discolors and becomes chalky. You don't want that to happen. And by looking at the diffusion, if I have these small pockets of fat, well, the water will diffuse within the pocket, but then it can't go further. And so if I measure the diffusion response, I can tell whether it's confined to a sphere, and I can tell the size of that sphere. And the diffusion coefficient of water is 3 microns squared per millisecond. These pockets are about 5 microns, and so it's easy to measure. And the T1 that limits how well we can do this for fats is a few seconds, and so we can do it actually very, very well. So all cheese gets NMR. chocolate, only the very best chocolate. So you know, if you want to check, you have to bring your own NMR to the chocolate store. Okay, so we'll start with envies on Tuesday. Thanks.